Percy, standing beside Felicity, who for the first time in all of her born days seems too shocked to be smirking, and with them, the Lord Ambassador and his wife. We all gape at each other. Or rather, they gape at me. There's really nothing to do but pretend I'm fully clothed and in control of the situation, so I walk up to Percy and say, "There you are! I think we should be going." They're all staring at me. The whole courtyard is staring at me, but it's Percy and Felicity that I feel the most. Felicity's got her fish mouth in place, but Percy's shock is starting to fade, and he looks embarrassed. Of me or for me, it's hard to say. "My lord," the ambassador says, and I turn, still trying to play dead casual. His wife squeaks. "Yes, sir?" His face is scarlet. "Have you any possible explanation for your current state of dress?" "Undress," I correct him. "And thank you so much for a lovely evening. It's been quite revealing. But we're expected home, so we'll hear from you soon. We should have you for supper before we move south. Percy? Felicity?" I would take their arms, but my hands are otherwise occupied, so I tip my chin up and begin to walk away and hope to God they will follow me. They both do, though neither says a word. When we're at last installed again in our carriage by some rather wide-eyed attendants, I drop my shield and start to shuffle back into my breeches. Felicity throws up her hands with a shriek, "Dear God, Monty, my eyes!" I arch my back, trying to wriggle in without striking my head on one of the hanging lanterns. "Shame you haven't your attractive specs on."
"What were you doing?"
"Look at what I'm wearing and make an educated guess." I fasten my breeches, then look over at Percy, who is staring forward, stone-faced. "What's the matter with you?" His mouth tightens. "Are you drunk?"
"Excuse me?"
"Are you drunk?" he repeats. "Have you ever seen him sober?" Felicity says under her breath. Percy's still staring away from me, though that stare is turning into a glare.
"Can't you control yourself? Ever?"
"I'm sorry, are you getting on me to behave? You aren't exactly a saintly enough candidate to be delivering a morality lecture, darling.
Do you think I could ever act the way you do and get away with it?"
"What does that mean?"
"Look at me and take a guess."
"Really? You want to have that conversation right now? You let everyone walk all over you because your skin's a bit dark."
"Oh, dear God, Monty, stop," Felicity says.
"But if you'd grow a spine, I wouldn't have to stand up for you because you'd do it yourself." He looks for a moment, too astonished to speak. Felicity's gaping at me too, and I have a deep sense I have said something very wrong. But then Percy tips his chin up. "If that was me caught naked with some person at the palace, I wouldn't have been permitted to walk away from that garden the way you just did." I start to say something, but he interrupts, his voice slicing. "Aren't you tired of this? Aren't you tired of being this person? You look like a drunken ass all the time, all the bloody time, and it's getting..."
"It's getting what, Percy?"
He's not going to say it, so I offer the word up for him. "Embarrassing? Are you embarrassed of me?" He doesn't reply, which is answer enough. I wait for defiance to filter through me, but instead I'm filled with it too, that hot, rancid shame rising like a fetid tide.
"Who was she?" Felicity demands. "It was a she, wasn't it?"
I pull my shirt over my head with a bit more force than is needed. The collar snags my hair.
"A girl I met."
"And what happened to her?"
"I don't know, I bolted."
"You were caught with a woman and then you left her there? Monty, you tomcat."
"She'll be fine. They didn't chase me down."
"Because you're a man."
"So?"
"It's different for women. No one condemns a man for that sort of thing, but she'll carry that with her."
"It won't matter. She's someone's mistress. She's just a whore."
Felicity's hands fist around her dress, and for a moment I think she may slap me. But the carriage strikes a rut, and we're all three nearly unseated. She catches herself on the window treatments, then glares at me again.
"Don't you dare," she says, her voice low and tight. "Say anything like that ever again. This is your fault, Henry. No one else's."
I look to Percy, but he's staring out the window now with his face still stone, and I realize what a stupid mistake it was to think Percy gave half a damn what I was doing with a French courtier in a back room. I slink down in my seat and hate them both intensely. I've been betrayed.
Felicity's never been on my side, but I thought I could count on Percy. Though now, it seems the whole world has been scrambled up.
6.
I intend to sleep the next morning until I can sleep no more, but Sinclair wakes me early. The sky outside my window is still opaline with the sunrise. It takes me a while to rally myself to get out of bed, partly because I'm wrung out, and partly because I'm absolutely writhing at the thought of looking Percy and Felicity in the eyes. Mostly Percy. I'm also feeling worse than I expected. I didn't think I had drunk that much, thanks to the Lord Ambassador's blockade, but my stomach won't sit still, and my whole body feels as though it's been dragged behind a carriage. I roll from bed after at least a half of an hour and scrub water from the basin in the corner across my face. I'm light-headed and wobbly when I raise my head to the glass, and I stagger sideways, stepping directly onto my balled-up coat from the night previous. A sharp stab of pain goes through my foot, and I sit down hard with a yelp. I've stepped upon the box I picked up in the Duke's apartments. It's still in the pocket of my coat, with its edges snagged in the stitchery. It's stranger in the daylight and away from the delirious shine of the party. I spin the dials round, spelling out the first few letters of my name. In the wake of my grand exit, I forgot I took it, though now the same sort of savage pleasure I got the night before at pocketing it comes back, which is the only good thing about the morning thus far. I tuck the box into my coat pocket, a reminder that I am somewhat clever and not everything is terrible. When I finally drag myself from my room, I find that we are packing. The servants have trunks open and spread out across the sitting room. A few are being hauled below stairs. Felicity is at the breakfast table, staring at her novel with too much determination to be natural, and Lockwood is beside her, a damask banyan over his suit and his eyes fixed upon my bedroom door, waiting for me. The news of my display has most certainly reached him. Nothing travels quite so swiftly as gossip. Mr. Lockwood stands up and fastens his banyan as furiously as I have ever seen anyone fasten anything.
I see I have been too lax in my discipline.
Discipline? I repeat. All the banging luggage has got a headache throbbing against my eyes.
We're on our tour. We're meant to be having a good time.
A good time, yes, but this, my lord, is unacceptable. You shamed your hosts, who were kind enough to bring you to a social event you should have been grateful to attend. You debased your father's good name before his friends. Each one of your foolish actions reflects as much upon him as it does upon you. You, he says, his voice pinched up as tight as his forehead, are an embarrassment.
Several hours from now, I will certainly think of a retort to this, a perfect combination of wit and defiance that would leave him stumbling. But in that moment, I can't think of a damn thing, so I stand there, struck dumb, and let him scold me like a child.
I did warn you, Lockwood says, as did your father, that inappropriate behavior would not be tolerated. So you and I will be returning to England forthwith.
I swear the floor drops out from beneath me at the thought of seeing my father again so much quicker than I anticipated, and under such grim circumstances.
However, Mr. Lockwood continues, as I'm responsible for seeing your sister to school, we'll be departing for Marseille this morning to deliver her before we return.
At the table, Felicity winces a little, but Lockwood takes no notice.
Once Miss Montague has been installed, Mr. Newton will go north to Holland, and you and I will leave for England, where you will take responsibility before your father for your actions.
Don't come back at all. I can still hear him say it. I don't want to go home, I say, and my feeble attempt to varnish over my panic turns the words far more petulant than I intend. It wasn't that bad.
My lord, your behavior was disgraceful. Doubly so since you deny the impropriety. You are ashamed to yourself, and to your family name.
He's brandy-faced and reckless now, and even as he speaks again, I can see that he doesn't mean to say it, but it doesn't matter, because he does.
No wonder your father doesn't want you around.
I want to knock his nose flat for saying that. Instead, I throw up on his slippers, which is only slightly less satisfying. Our journey to Marseille is uncomfortable in both the literal and the more abstract senses of the word. Lockwood clearly chose to flee the burning remains of my reputation in Paris before anyone had time to properly smell the smoke, so arrangements for our flight are cobbled together. Sinclair is sent ahead for lodging in Marseille, but inns along the way are scarce, and we often find ourselves scrambling for housing. It would be easier, but we've got Felicity, and most places don't take ladies, or Negroes either, and Percy's just dark enough that we're sometimes barred because of him. Our progress is slow. The roads are rougher than those from Calais to Paris. We break an axle tree outside of Lyon, which delays us almost half a day. We left our Parisian staff and a good deal of luggage to follow us later. We travel with only a valet and a coachman, so I'm doing far more of my own upkeep than I'm accustomed to. We wake each morning to a blistering sun, and I'm soaked in sweat before noonday. None of us are speaking to each other. Felicity keeps her nose tucked into her novel, finishes it by the end of the first day, then immediately begins it again. Lockwood makes a study of Lassalle's The Voyage of Italy, which seems like simply a means of reminding me of the places we won't see because of the damage I've wrought. Percy looks everywhere but at me, and when we stop to lodge on the first night, he asks Lockwood to get us separate rooms, which is the most openly spiteful gesture I've ever received from him. On the fifth day of the most uncomfortable breed of silence I've ever endured, we shift from pastured countryside into woodlands, crackled trees with bare, slim trunks sheltering the rutted road from the summer heat. Their branches scrape against the carriage roof like fingers as we pass beneath them. We've seen few other travellers in the forest, so the sounds of horses, then men's voices, startle us all. Felicity even looks up from her book. Lockwood twitches back the drapes for a view of the road. Our carriage flails to a halt, so abrupt that Lockwood nearly pitches out of the window. I catch myself on Felicity, who shoulders me off. "Why have we stopped?" Percy asks. The voices get louder, angry and persistent French I can't understand. The carriage dips as our coachman climbs down.
"Out!" a voice barks. "Tell your passengers to disembark or they will be made to."
The carriage bounces again, then there's a crack. A moment later, one of our trunks drops past the window and smashes against the ground. "What's going on?" Felicity says quietly.
"Out! Now!" someone shouts.
Lockwood peers through the gap in the drapes, then snaps back into his seat. His face is white.
"Highwayman," he says under his breath.
"Highwayman?" I cry, loud as he was soft. "Are we actually being robbed by honest-to-God highwaymen?"
"Don't panic,"
Lockwood instructs, though he looks panicked.
"I've read what to do."
"You've read?" I repeat. I half expect Felicity to leap to the defense of reading, but she's got her mouth clamped shut. Her knuckles are white around the spine of her book.
"We will comply with all their demands," Lockwood says. "Most highwaymen are simply looking for easy money and to get away quickly. Things can be replaced."
There's a loud thwack on the side of the carriage like someone slapped it. We all jump. Percy's hand fastens around my knee. Lockwood blanches, then straightens his coat.
"I shall reason with them. Do not leave this carriage unless I instruct you to do so."
And into the breach he goes. The three of us stay statued inside, the silence between us a very loud thing. The carriage shakes as the highwaymen unfasten the rest of our trunks from the roof. It won't take them long to go through the little luggage we have with us and pick out the shiny things. Then they'll let us go, and we will proceed to Marseille with a bit less baggage and an excellent war story that will impress all the lads back home. That is what I tell myself in my head, though the brash instructions from outside seem to say otherwise. Then the carriage door bangs open, and the business end of a hunting knife is thrust in.
"Out!"
a man yells in French.
"Sortez! Get out!"
I'm shaking like mad, but I've got my wits about me enough to obey. Outside, I count 5 men, though I think there may be more on the other side. They're all dressed in greatcoats and spatterdashes, their faces covered with black kerchiefs, and they're armed with an impressive array of weaponry, though most look fancier than I would have expected from bandits. If the situation weren't so dire, I'd comment on how quintessentially highwaymanish they look, as though they borrowed the outfits from the theatre. Across from the carriage door, Lockwood is on his knees with his hands on his head, one of the well-costumed highwaymen holding a pistol to the base of his skull. Our coachman is spread-eagled in the ditch, the soil around his head dark. I'm not sure if he's dead or just insensible, but the sight stops me in my tracks.
On the ground!
A highwayman shouts at me. I have a history of reacting poorly when shouted at, particularly by men with French accents, and I freeze, stuck halfway out of the carriage, until Percy presses his fingers into my spine from behind. I stumble forward and fall to my knees, hands rising without my meaning them to. Our luggage has all been gutted, and the contents are strewn across the ground like a down of autumn leaves. I spot Lockwood's toilet case, drawers all wrenched open and bottles smashed into glittering sand. Pieces of our backgammon board are scattered amid stockings and garters and snarled neckwear. One of the men kicks a pile of Felicity's petticoats, and they blossom like upside-down tulips. One of the highwaymen shoves Percy to his knees at my side, Felicity on the other. Another ducks into the cab where we were just sitting. I hear him clattering around, then the toothy snap of a knife splitting up upholstery, before he emerges with nothing but Percy's fiddle case, which he tosses onto the ground and kicks open. "Please, it's only a fiddle," Percy cries, reaching out like he might stop the man. I can see his hand trembling. The highwayman handles the instrument gently, even as he shucks out the felt and tears open the rosin drawer like he's looking for something.
"Rien,"
he calls to the man behind me. "Please, put it back," Percy says quietly. "S'il vous plaît, remettez-le en place." And to my great surprise, the highwayman does. Either he's the most respectful bandit of all time, or he wants to keep it in good shape for when he pawns it. There's one man standing in the middle of it all who seems to be in charge, with a pistol hanging loosely at his side, and the other men frantic around him. A gold signet ring on his finger catches the light. It's large enough that, even from a distance, I can see it's inscribed with a crest, bearing the fleur-de-lis in triplicate. He's staring hard at me, and above his kerchief his eyes narrow. I flinch. Someone grabs the collar of my coat from behind and hauls me up, but the leader calls,
"Attends! Ne les tuez pas tout de suite!"
Don't kill them yet. "Yet?" I want to shout back at him. "What do you mean, yet? Like our murder is the inevitable ending to this scene?" We're all more willing to cooperate if they just take our things and let us be. The leader jerks his pistol in my direction, and all the fight in me evaporates.
"Où est-ce?"
Felicity has her head down, fingers knit behind her head, but she glances over at me. I can't make my brain remember a word of French after the declaration of our impending death, so I stammer, "What?"
"La boîte. Ce que vous avez volé. Rendez-le."
I translate a few words of this.
"Where's what? Où est-ce quoi?"
I have no idea what volé is.
"La boîte volée."
"What?"
I look wildly to Felicity for some sort of linguistic assistance. Her face is white.
"Il n'y a rien,"
one of the men calls from the other side of the carriage. The man holding me flings me to the ground so I'm on my back looking up. The sunlight blots as the highwayman's leader steps over to me, pistol swinging lazily at his side. My panic is a living thing.
"C'est où?"
"I don't know what you're saying," I cry.
He takes a step forward, his heavy black boot landing straight on my hand and easing down. My bones start to protest.
"Do you understand me now, my lord?"
he says in English. And I wish in that moment that I were brave. I wish to God I were. But I'm shaking and terrified, and out of the corner of my eye I can see our coachman's body on the ground, blood seeping from his forehead, and I don't want to die or get my fingers broken off like dry tree limbs. I haven't a courageous bone in my body. If I knew what they were looking for, short of it being my own damn sister, I would have handed it over without a thought. But I'm clueless and helpless, and as the highwayman presses his foot down on my fingers, all I can think is, nothing bad has ever happened to me before. Nothing bad has ever happened in my whole life.
"Stop it! We don't know what you're talking about!"
Felicity cries.
"Nous n'avons rien volé!"
The highwayman steps off my hand, but he keeps addressing me as he walks backward to Felicity.
"What if I rip her fingers off? Perhaps you'll tell me then."
He jerks a knife out of his belt, but suddenly, in a feat of unexpected heroics straight out of an adventure novel, Percy grabs his fiddle case from the ground and swings it like a brick bat. It connects with the skull of the leader, and he topples to the ground. Felicity seems to take her cue from this, for she snatches up one of her petticoats from the soil, flings it in the face of the man with his gun on her, then slams her elbow between his legs so he's down for the count. I scramble to my feet and start to stagger away, not certain where I'm going other than getting the holy hell away from here, but one of the highwaymen grabs a handful of my coat and jerks me backward. I choke as my collar cinches around my neck. My first instinct is to faint with fear, but everyone else is being brave, and that makes me feel courageous too, so instead I whip around and throw my first ever punch straight at his chin. And it bloody well hurts. No one warns you that knocking a man across the jaw probably hurts you as much as it does whoever's getting your fist to their face. He and I both cuss at the same time, and I double over, just as a gun fires and a bullet goes flying over my head. I feel the whistle against the back of my neck, so perhaps throwing an incredibly inept punch saved my life. "Run!" I hear Lockwood shout, and Percy grabs me by the wrist and drags me off the road and into the trees, Felicity on our heels. She's got a fistful of her skirt hoisted nearly to her waist, and I get a view of a good deal more of my sister's legs than I ever wish to see. There's the crack of another gunshot, and something knocks me hard in the back of the head. I think for a minute I've been shot, but then I realize it was Percy swinging his violin case around to use like a shield. Behind us, I hear the horses scream, then the clatter of the coach wheels. I don't dare look to see if Lockwood and our company are making their escape as well. I'm too afraid of catching my foot on something and falling, and I can hear the bandits chasing us. The underbrush is crashing, and there's another gunshot, but we keep running. I don't know how long we can go for. I'm somehow feeling both as though I could sprint all the way to Marseille, fed only by fear, and as though my pounding heart is getting in the way of my lungs, making it hard to breathe deep enough. My throat is starting to feel raw. "Here, here, here!" Felicity cries and pulls me over a ridge slick with leaves. I lose my footing and sit down hard, tripping Percy, so that we both tumble down the slope like demented mountain goats, simultaneously trying to regain our footing and keep moving forward. "Over here!" Felicity hisses, and we clamber after her, behind a great rock jutting from the roots of a massive ash tree, and press ourselves up against its backside. I hear the highwaymen crash by us, their shouts waft behind them, fading to echoes like bird calls flitting between the trees. We sit for a long time, all of us gasping and trying to make no noise beyond that. We're breathing so hard it seems a miracle that that alone doesn't give us away. I can feel Felicity shaking next to me, and I realize suddenly that she's clutching my hand. I can't remember the last time I held hands with my sister. We hear the highwaymen retreat, then come back in our direction, but never close enough to be a threat. Eventually, the noise of them fades into silence, and the forest is nothing but the crackle of the trees. The rush is starting to fade, and a swell of pain goes through my palm. I peel my fingers from between Felicity's and shake my hand out a few times, wincing. "I think I broke my hand."
"You've not broken your hand," Felicity says.
"I should know, it's my hand."
"Let me see it."
I pull it up against my stomach.
"No.
Let me see."
Felicity grabs me around the wrist, then mashes her fingers into my palm. I yelp.
"It's not broken," she says.
"How do you know?"
"Because it's hardly swollen, and I can feel that the bones are all still intact."
I don't know how Felicity knows what bones are meant to feel like.
"But don't tuck your thumb into your fist next time you punch someone," she adds. I'm also not clear how Felicity knows the best way to throw a punch.
I look over at Percy. He's got his violin case pressed to his stomach, two fingers stuck into the pair of bullet holes now etched into the edges, as though he's plugging a leak.
"What do we do now?" he asks.
"Go back to the carriage," I say. It seems so obvious.
Felicity's brow puckers.
"Do you think we could find it again?
Or get lost, or ambushed?"
"They're highwaymen," I say. "They want money and then they run. They'll be long gone by now."
"I don't think those were highwaymen. They were looking for something. Something they thought we had, and they seemed rather determined to murder us for its possession."
"Is that what they were saying? I was sort of panicking."
"Do we have it?" Percy asks.
"Have what?" I say. "We don't know what they're after."
Felicity flicks a leaf off the hem of her dress, then says,
"If any of us is smuggling,
Now would be the time to come forward.
And then they both look at me.
What?
I protest.
Well, out of all of us, you seem the most likely to have picked up something, she replies. Did anyone drop something in your pocket while she had her tongue down your throat?
I'm about to complain, but, rake that I am, that tasteful phrasing on Felicity's part pricks a sudden vein of memory. One hand strays to my pocket, tented around the outline of the trinket box I took from the Duke of Bourbon. I had forgotten entirely that it was there.
Oh, no.
Percy looks sideways at me. Oh, no, what? I swallow.
I'd first like it to be noted that I am most certainly not a smuggler.
Monty, he says, my name sopping with dread.
And, I continue over top him, I'd like you to both remember just how much you adore me and how dull your lives would be without me in them.
What did you do?
I pull the box from my pocket and hold it flat on my palm for them to see.
Stole this?
From where?
Ah, Versailles.
Felicity snatches the box from my palm, dials clacking together like teeth when her fingers close around them. Henry Montague, I'm going to murder you in your sleep.
This can't be what they're looking for. It's puny. It's just a trinket box.
This, Felicity waggles it before my face, is not an ordinary trinket box.
Then what is it?
It's some sort of puzzle, right? Percy says, taking the box from Felicity. When you put the letters in the correct alignment, it opens. There's a word or cipher you have to spell.
He spins the dials a few times, then makes a trial of the latch, like his first guess might be right. Nothing happens.
Obviously it's meant to hide something or keep it safe.
And so Monty thought that might be the best thing to take, something clearly valuable, Felicity says.
It wasn't clearly valuable, I protest. It looked plain in comparison to everything else there.
It was in the palace. Why were you stealing from the king at all?
It wasn't the king's. We're in someone else's apartments.
You stole from someone important.
Yes, but why would highwaymen be after something belonging to a duke?
Enough, Percy interrupts. He presses the box back into my palm, then says, Monty took this. Nothing we can do about that now, so we should try to find the road and join back up with our company, if they got away.
That if hangs very heavy. It makes me squirm to think that if those highwaymen truly were after the box, and if any of our company didn't escape them, that would be on my shoulders.
How far do you think we are from Marseille?
He looks to me, but I can't remember, so I just stare back blankly.
Lockwood said it would take a week, Felicity offers. We've been travelling for 5 days, so we must be close. I think our best strategy would be to find the road, start toward Marseille, and hope Lockwood escaped and we can join up with him.
How? I ask. We don't know where the road is.
Monty, why don't you worry about making certain your hand isn't broken? Felicity says.
It's the verbal equivalent of tossing me something shiny to hold my attention while the adults talk. I glower at her, though she's gone swivel-eyed through the trees and doesn't notice.
We go south. Percy traces the sun's path across the sky with his finger, then points. Toward the sea. The road was heading south.
So, Felicity says, we walk south until we find a road, then see if we meet up with Lockwood, or else find a carriage or a wagon that will take us the rest of the way. Our equipage will be in Marseille soon, unless Lockwood and our men didn't make it. She swallows, then scrubs a hand under her nose.
I think it's best to assume they did and plan for any eventualities, only if we find evidence to the contrary.
Percy nods, and they both seem so certain about it that I feel like the stupidest person there.
Well then, I say, like I was a critical part of the planning, that's decided.
I try to rise, but I'm shakier than I expected, and my legs go straight out from under me. I end up slumping forward into the brush, soaking my knees in the damp soil.
Don't stand so fast, Felicity instructs from behind me, and take a deep breath or you're going to faint.
I think about arguing, but she actually seems to know what she's talking about. I roll onto my back and stare up at the sky, wide and open above us like a tossed picnic blanket shaken from its folds.
At least Percy saved his violin, I say,
and Percy lets out a grateful, breathy laugh.
7. We walk, without seeing any sign of our carriage, or an end to the trees, or even a sliver of road, until the sun is nearly set. And then it's an empty road that we find, not a light or a house in sight. Percy is the first to suggest what we are all thinking, which is stopping to sleep, since it doesn't seem likely we'll find anywhere to stay before we collapse. Summer is peaking like whipped meringue, and the night is thick-aired and damp. Crickets strum from the underbrush. This is altogether a different sort of evening than I was hoping for, I say, as we spread ourselves in the warm shadow of a white-barked poplar tree. Disappointed? Percy asks. I'm gasping for a drink. It's all I've been thinking of for the last several hours, trying to calculate the best-case scenario for getting alcohol in me fast. But I just laugh. Percy stretches out beside me, which makes my skin stand on end, until he puts his violin case deliberately between us. I take that as my sign to stay away. Felicity lies down on my other side and curls up with her hands pillowed under her head. "If you keep rubbing your hand like that," she says to me, "you might actually break it." I hadn't realized I was. "It bloody hurts!" Should have been better at punching. "How was I supposed to know there was a correct way to do it?" "On that subject, how do you know?" "How do you not know?" she counters. "That can't be the first time you've hit someone." "With any degree of seriousness, yes." "You hit me once at the pond," Percy says. "Yes, but we were boys, and it was more of a smack, and you were teasing me because I wouldn't put my head under the water, so you deserved it." "What about when you came home all black and blue from Eton?" Felicity asks. I try to laugh, but my throat closes up around the sound, and it comes out a bit more like I'm drowning. "That wasn't from a fight." "That's what Mother told me." "Yes, well, parents lie." "Why would she lie about that?" "Hmm. I think you're lying to me." "I'm not. I think you got in a fight and that's why they expelled you. You came home so bashed up. I remember. You must have done something nasty enough to get one of the other boys to put his fist in your face." "Nope. You're not one to start fights, but I assumed you'd at least have swung back." "It wasn't another boy. It was Father." Silence drops upon us like wet wool. The trees whisper as the wind rakes through them, leaves moon-stained and glittering. Between the branches I can see the stars so bright and thick that the sky looks sugared. Then Felicity says, "Oh." My eyes are starting to pinch and I screw up my face against it. "Good old Father." "I didn't know that, I swear. Mother told me..." "Why are we talking about this?" I laugh again because I don't know what else to do. I want a drink so badly I'm ready to sprint to the next town for it. I press my fists against my eyes and suck in a sharp breath as pain shoots down my wrist. "My hand is absolutely broken." "It's not broken," Felicity says, and the exasperation behind her voice makes me feel better. "I think it might be." "It's not." "We should sleep," Percy says. "Right." I turn onto my side and find myself face to face with him. In the moonlight, his skin looks like polished stone. He smiles at me, so sympathetic it makes me shrivel up. "Poor Monty," it says, and I want to die when I think of him pitying me. "Poor Monty with a father who beats you until you bleed. Poor Monty with a fortune to inherit and an estate to run. Poor Monty who's useless and embarrassing." "Good night," Percy says, then rolls over, away from me. "Poor Monty, in love with your best friend." As it happens, there is no way to get comfortable on the ground, as it's primarily composed of dirt and rocks and other sharp things that there's a reason no one stuffs their mattresses with. I'm bone-weary from the day, an ache left over from the panic still lingering in my limbs. But I lie for a long time on my back, then my side, then my other side, trying to cozy up and fall asleep and think about something that isn't how hard it is to be stone-cold sober, or my father beating the shit out of me after I was expelled from school. It's running circles in my mind, all the vicious details of that week. My father's face as the headmaster explained what had happened. The way that after a while he'd been hitting me for long enough that I heard more than felt the blows landing. the exquisite discomfort of the carriage ride home, my ribs rattling around in my chest every time we hit a rut, and my head packed up tight like it was full of cotton. All the things he called me that I'll never forget. I had woken at home the next morning in the worst pain of my life, so sore I could hardly get out of bed, but my father made me come to breakfast and sit beside him. My mother didn't say a word about why I'd arrived home looking like I'd run face first into a stone wall at top speed, and the idea of father being the reason I was swollen and bruised would have been so absurd to Felicity, it apparently never crossed her mind. Halfway through breakfast, I excused myself to go vomit in the back garden, and when no one came after me, I stayed there, lying on the lawn beside the pond with no strength to get up. It was the same sort of day as when we left for our tour, grey and stifling, the air sweating from a storm the night before and the sky threatening to tear open again. Patches of the garden path were still dark, and the grass was so damp that I was wet to the skin in minutes. But I didn't move. I lay flat on my back, staring at the clouds and waiting for rain, shame rattling around inside me like a marble in a jar. After a time, a shadow fell across my face, and when I opened my eyes, there was Percy, silhouetted against the bright sky as he peered down at me. Christ! Hello there, darling. My voice broke on the final word because, of course, I needed this moment to be more humiliating than it already was. How was your term?
Jesus Christ, what happened?
Eton threw me out.
I heard, that's not what I'm concerned about right now.
Oh, this? I waved a hand vaguely at my face, trying not to wince as I felt the pull in my ribs like the tightening of a violin string. Don't I look dashing?
Monty.
Piratical is perhaps a better word.
Please be serious.
Took a dozen men to bring me down.
Who did this?
Who do you think? Percy didn't say anything to that. Instead, he lay down next to me, our faces side by side, but our bodies pointing in opposite directions. A bird swooped low above us, chittering merrily.
So why'd they toss you out? He asked.
Well, I had a bit of a gambling enthusiasm.
Everyone at Eton has a gambling enthusiasm. It's not enough to expel you.
It was enough for them to search my rooms, and there was found some incriminating correspondence between myself and that lad I wrote to tell you about, which was rather enough.
Oh, God.
In my defense, he was very handsome.
And they told your father about them, did they?
Oh, he got to read them all and then throw them back at me, literally. Some of them he read aloud to punctuate... I swiped a hand across the side of my face that felt less like an open wound. Percy pretended not to see. So now he's going to be home more to keep an eye on me. Not so much time away in London, and that's entirely my fault. I'm going to have to see him all the time and be around him all the bleeding time, and it's not going to change anything.
I know.
If he could beat this out of me, I would have let him long ago. The clouds shifted and churned above us, spreading like blood across the sky. At the edge of the lawn, the pond tested its shores. Harpsichord music drifted through the parlour windows, heavy-handed scales played at top speed, Felicity practising with great indignance. "I wish I were dead," I said, then closed my eyes, or rather I, one being out of commission, so I wouldn't have to see Percy look at me. But I felt the grass prickle my neck as he shifted.
"Do you mean that?"
It wasn't the first time I'd thought it, wouldn't be the last either, though I didn't know that then, but it was the first time I'd said it aloud to anyone. It's a strange thing to want to die, stranger still when you don't feel you deserve to get away so easily. I should have fought myself harder, kept it all better penned. Shouldn't have wanted to act on my unnatural instincts. Shouldn't have felt so grateful and relieved and not alone for the first time in my life when St. John Westfall kissed me behind the dormitories on St. Mark's Eve, and so certain no one could ever make me ashamed for it. Not the headmaster, or my friends back home, or the other boys in my year. The whole while between being found out and waiting to be collected, I'd felt so defiant and righteous, unshakable in my surety that I'd done nothing wrong. But my father had knocked that straight out of me. "I don't know," I said. "Yes, maybe."
Well, don't do that. Don't want to be dead, here.
Percy nudged me with his shoulder until I opened my eyes. He had his arm extended straight above us, fingers splayed wide.
Here are 5 reasons not to be dead. Number 1, because your birthday is next month, and I already have something really excellent for you, and you don't want to die before I give it to you.
I laughed a little at that, but I was so near tears it ended up sounding less like a laugh and more like a slurp.
Percy didn't comment.
Number 2, he was ticking them off on his fingers as he went. If you weren't around, there'd be no one who's worse than me at billiards. You're so rubbish at billiards, it makes me look quite a bit better than I actually am.
Number 3, I wouldn't have anyone who would hate Richard Peel with me.
I hate Richard Peel, I said quietly.
We hate Richard Peel, Percy seconded, so loud that a bird took flight from the hedgerow.
I laughed again, and it sounded more human this time.
Number 4, we still have never managed to slide all the way down the staircase at my house on a serving tray, and without you there, the inevitable victory will be hollow.
And 5, he folded his thumb into his fist and pressed it up to the sky.
If you weren't here, everything would be the worst. Abso-bloody-lutely awful. It'd be dull and lonely and just...
Don't, all right? Don't be dead. I'm sorry you were expelled, and I'm sorry about your father. But I'm so glad you're home, and I really need you right now. So don't wish you were dead, because I'm so glad that you're not.
Silence for a moment. Then Percy said, all right?
And I said, all right.
Percy climbed to his feet and offered me a hand. He was gentle about it, but I still winced as he pulled me up. And he had to steady me with a soft touch to my elbow. He'd gotten taller since I'd seen him at Christmas. Somehow he suddenly had a good 5 inches on me, and he'd broadened out a bit as well, not so lanky and knobby and 90% knees like he'd always been growing up. His limbs didn't seem too long for his body anymore. When I look back on it now, I realize that must have been the first time, in all the while we'd known each other, it occurred to me that Percy might actually be rather handsome.
Perspective is a goddamn son of a bitch.
Marseille. 8. We are 3 days on the road, sleeping in sheltered groves and hitching rides on farmers' carts through fields of close-fisted sunflowers and blooming lavender. We reach Marseille in the late evening. The link boys are already out trimming the lantern wicks. It's a sprawling, shining city, cleaner and brighter than Paris. Notre Dame de la Garde sits high on the hill above the sea, its white stone reflecting back the sunset as it caramelizes across the breakers, turning the waves gold. The streets of the Panier are narrow and high, wet washing strung between the windows, catching the sunlight and flashing like glass. The banks are all shut up for the day, and as our plan was to find Father's bank and see if a message from Lockwood or Sinclair has been left for us, we're rather foiled. It seems we're condemned to spend another night exposed to the elements, unless we go knocking on doors at random, which makes me want to throw myself into the sea. I'm sore head to toe from the walking and the sleeping on hard ground, and my stomach is scratching against my spine. We've been eating a mixture of thieved and charitable scraps for days, and the meagre breakfast swapped for Felicity's earrings this morning left me long ago. As we wander down the main road toward the fort guarding the harbour, we stumble upon a fair set up along the water, red and white striped tents with ribbons knotted to their ropes and fluttering in the breeze. Paper garlands are strung over the walkways, and the air smells of boiling oil and the mealy tang of beer. Carts of food are lined up between the tents, piled with cheeses rolled in wax, greased turkey legs, skillets filled with candied almonds, and sweet rolls domed with liquefied sugar and berry coulis. It seems the most nickable supper we are going to find. Felicity takes charge of the thievery, so Percy and I find a table on the pier to wait for her, looking out across the syrupy water and the flocks of ships moored there, gulls flailing between them like snowflakes riding the wind. We sit on either side, Percy's fiddle case between us. The wood grain is rough and weathered by years of being chewed at by the spray kicked up from the sea. I'm so tired I put my head down and close my eyes.
Never thought I'd say this, but I'll be glad to see Lockwood.
Percy laughs wearily. Are you getting sentimental? God, no. He's got our banknotes. I want a real drink, and a real bed, and real food. I could ravish a plate of cakes right now. When Percy doesn't reply, I sit up. He's got his head balanced on his fists, and he looks weary. More than weary, verging on ill, clammy and absent, though I'm likely in an equally sorry state. You look poorly. He doesn't answer for a moment, then glances up like he only just realized I spoke. What? You don't look well. He shakes his head a few times to rouse himself. I'm tired. So am I. We should be stronger than this. Though I suppose we did just walk across France. We didn't walk across France, Felicity says as she flops down on the bench beside me. She's got a gibassier bun in each hand, fine grains of aniseed from the filling dusting her fingers. We eat with the sound of the sea and the tinkling melody of fair music underscoring our silence. I finish much faster than Percy or Felicity, who both seem to be trying to savour theirs while I opted for the method of gentlemanly inhalation. I suck the flakes of pastry off my fingers, then wipe my hands on my coattails, leaving oily tracks behind. My wrist knocks against the box in my pocket, and I pull it out and spin the dials. Felicity watches me, a thin strand of candied orange peel pinched between her thumb and forefinger. Describe for us what brilliant logic it was that led you to think stealing from the French king was a good idea. It wasn't the king, it was his minister. I believe stealing from a minister to the king is still a capital offence. You're going to have to return it, you know. Why? It's just a trinket box. Because, firstly, we are being pursued for it. Allegedly. She rolls her eyes. Secondly, because it's not yours, and thirdly, because it was an incredibly childish thing to do. You're going to make a very fine governess someday with that enthusiasm for rule following, I say with a scowl. That finishing school will have nothing to teach you. She sticks the pad of her thumb in her mouth and sucks at a spot of glaze. Perhaps I don't want to go to school. Of course you do. You've been whining for years about how badly you want schooling, and now you can stop being obnoxious because you're finally going. Her mouth puckers. You know, saying things like that might be the reason most people find you insufferable. People find me insufferable? When you use that sort of phraseology, yes, it's a word I'd use. I'm just being honest. Be a little less honest and a little more tactful. You've put up such a fuss. Yes, for education, an actual education, not finishing school. They're going to squeeze me into corsets and bully me into silence. It's true, Felicity's not a broken horse. A finishing school will kick the spirit straight out of her. And while I've never been particularly fond of my sister, the thought of a quiet, simpering, cross-stitching, tea-sipping Felicity feels like a slash through a painting. I almost begin to feel a bit sorry for her. But then she wrecks that with a sour, "Do you know how horrid it feels to watch my brother get tossed out of the best boarding school in England, then get to travel the continent as a reward, while I'm stuck behind, not permitted to study the same things or read the same books or even visit the same places while we're abroad, just because I had the bad luck to be born a girl?" "Reward?" My temper is starting to rise to match hers. "You think this tour is a reward? This is a last meal before my execution." "Oh, how tragic. You have to run an estate and be a lord and have a good, rich, cozy life on your own terms." I gape at her, mostly because I thought we had developed some understanding between us after what I had confessed to her the night of the highwayman's attack, that there is nothing cozy about the life I'll be walking back to at the end of this year. But here she is, spitting in my face like a mouthful of melon seeds. "Leave him alone, Felicity," Percy says quietly. Felicity flicks a pastry flake from her thumb with the tip of her finger, then says, with an upturned nose, "How lucky we would all be to have the problems of Henry Montagu." I stand up, because Felicity learned to be mean from our father, and with each snide comment, the shade of him is filtering through, darker and darker. "Where are you going?" Percy calls. "To wash all this damn sap off my hands," I say, though it's fairly transparent I'm storming off because of my sister. I walk for a minute, directionless, my head fuzzy with anger and also a lot of wanting for a drink, before I realize I have no clue where I'm going and I've got to be able to find my way back to Percy and Felicity. I stop. A group of children skate by me, their hands linked and their hair flying behind them, angling toward a man setting up a projector for a magic lantern show,
A woman outside a viciously green tent shouts in my direction, "Look into my eye for a sight of your own death, only a sou for a glance." A pair of acrobats balance on their hands over the edge of the pier to applause from a sparse audience.
"Vos pieds sont douloureuses," someone says behind me, and I turn.
A wooden stand with a purple awning is set up against the edge of the pier, the word apothicaire stenciled over a slop of red paint on the front. A man with coarse graying hair, a leather apron thrown over his patchy coat, is behind the counter, leaning against it on his elbows. Behind him, shelves are stuffed with an assortment of bottles and vials, labels peeling away like dead skin, and the monikers of their tinctures sketched in spidery handwriting across them. A gallery of maladies.
"Pardon?"
I say when I realize he's addressing me.
"Sorry?"
"Vos pieds. Your feet. You have sore feet."
"How do you know that?"
"You're walking on them strangely, like they're hurting you. You need an ointment."
"Bet you say that to everyone who passes."
"I don't always mean it."
"You? I'm worried for your feet."
"I'm walking fine."
"Then something else.
You're too stiff to be without pain. A mistake of the young, maybe? A venereal pox?"
"What? No, definitely not that." He waggles a finger at me.
"You're not well. I can tell it."
I try to edge away, but he keeps talking, his voice getting louder the farther I go, and I don't want some randy medicine man shouting across the pier that I've got something festering on my bits, so I snap at him, more peevish than I intend. "I'm not unwell. I'm unhappy." He seems unmoved.
"Is there much of a difference? I have tonics for your feet, and metrical charms my grandmothers can concoct for your ill humor."
He taps his finger at a row of witch bottles on a low shelf, their contents tar-like and frothing. "Well, I'm not interested. Even if I had coins to spare, they wouldn't be spent on you and your daft charms." I start to walk away again before he can say anything more about whatever I got wrong with my head, or my feet, or my bits. So hasty I sideswipe a cart of oranges behind me, sending a tower of them collapsing in all directions. The cart man starts to shout at me, and I'm so flustered that I immediately forget every word I know in French. "Sorry," I say in English. "Sorry. Désolé." I start scooping oranges off the path before they get stepped on or kicked into the harbour. Two get away from me and plop into the water. I want to sit down where I stand and scream. One of the oranges rolls down the planking and a man stops it with the toe of his boot. I'm about to scramble forward and grab it when he reaches down and I catch the flash of a gold signet ring on his finger. The same ring the highwayman was wearing when he and his gang laid siege. The highwaymen have found us. By some impossible coincidence, we've been Dick Turpined and then tracked down. Or perhaps there's nothing coincidental about it. Perhaps Felicity was right, and they were looking for us after all. They've come for the box. The man with the gold ring is moving to put the orange back on the cart from the other side, so I scramble out of the way before he can see me and hide in the only place available, which is behind the counter of the apothecary stall. The apothecary doesn't look down, but his lips pull into a taut smile.
"Friends of yours?"
he says. And though his eyes are elsewhere, it's clear he's addressing me.
"Please, don't say anything to them," I hiss.
"Can I help you, gentlemen?" he calls. "That's quite a bruise, sir. How did you come by it?"
"That's not your concern."
It's the same voice from the forest, confirmed when the man's fingers curl over the counter. That ring is unmistakable. He's leaning over, squinting at the labels on the bottles as the apothecary runs his fingers over them. "Don't look down," I think. "Dear God, please don't look down."
"If I knew the cause, I could better treat it," the apothecary says. "A bleeding beneath the skin takes a different salve than a slip and fall."
"I was struck in the head with a fiddle case,"
the highwayman snaps, his disdain palpable.
"Does that help your diagnosis, mountebank?"
Definitely our assailants, unless there is a rash of tourists using instruments to fend off Toby Gills of late.
"Where'd that boy go?"
I hear the man with the orange cart shout. My heart's really sitting on my lungs. It's getting hard to breathe around it.
"The balm of Gilead, then, applied twice daily, will take down the swelling."
The apothecary almost trips over me as he turns back to the counter.
The tin lands a little harder than is natural, but the highwayman must not notice. I hear the chink of coins on the counter, then the men's boots as they retreat. The apothecary keeps his face up, but after a moment says to me, "They've gone around back toward the city. You'd best go the other way if you're avoiding them." I pull myself up with one hand on the shelves. The bottles tremble against each other. "Thank you." The apothecary shrugs. "They look fierce and you look helpless. Do you owe them money?" "They think I owe them something." I check to make certain the highwaymen are truly gone. The man with the orange cart has been blessedly distracted by the start of the magic lantern show. Then bolt in the other direction, my shoes slapping the damp planking with an empty thwack. Percy and Felicity are, thank God, right where I left them, still at the table with Percy's fiddle between them. Somehow Felicity still has a bite of her gibassier left, gummed to her thumb, and she's nibbling at it. Percy's got his head in his hands and is massaging his temples. He doesn't raise his head, even when I skid up beside them and proclaim, "They found us." "Who?" Felicity asks. "Mr. Lockwood?" "No, the highwaymen. The men who attacked us, they're here." "How do you know it's them?" "I saw them. One of them has this ring. I remember it." Felicity is already on her feet. "Do you think they're looking for us?" "Why else would they be here? You think the group of bandits who attacked us just happened to be strolling through a fair at the same time we are?" "We need to go. We need to see if Lockwood's arrived and find where our company is." "No, we need to find out if they're actually after this." And here I snatch up the puzzle box from where it's still sitting on the table between them. "And return it, so they'll let us alone." "You think we should go looking for the men who are ready to kill us?" Felicity asks. "They're not going to let us walk away after we give them what they want. We need to get out of here. Percy, are you certain you're well?" Percy looks far less well than he did when I left. He keeps squinting, like the light is too bright, and he's sweating and doesn't look quite here. I can't think of another way to describe it, but he stands up, shouldering his fiddle case. "I'm fine, let's go." "How are we going to find Lockwood?" I ask as we weave through the crowd, Felicity in the lead. "Do you know where he meant for us to stay?" she asks. "No, he sent Sinclair." "Well, do you know Father's bank here? We could ask them if they've accepted any letters in his name, or if Sinclair left word about accommodation." "No, maybe? It's the Bank of England, I think."
"You think?"
"Yes, it is. Wait, yes. Do you ever listen, Henry, or is everything just sweet nothings in your ear?" I look up as we round a corner and catch a glimpse of exactly the troop of men we are trying to avoid, down the path ahead of us and coming our way. I grab Felicity's arm and jerk her backward between two of the tents, nearly tripping myself when my shin catches one of the ropes, tying them off. Percy dodges next to me, his fiddle case clutched to his chest. "They're right there," I hiss. Felicity peers out from between the tents, then ducks back to my side. "You're certain that's them?" "I'm certain that one of them is wearing the same ring as the man who attacked us."
"That's not a whole lot of certainty, is it?"
"He's also got the imprint of Percy's fiddle case carved into his forehead, so how much more would you like?" Shadows stretch along the pier, preceding their casters, and we all sink back. I try to think small and invisible thoughts, willing them to not look at us, not see us, not turn as they pass. I gladly toss the puzzle box at their heads as they go by, but Felicity's logic makes more sense than mine. They planned to kill us in the forest, and I can't imagine they'd let us go with a "thanks, chums," and a pat on the back now. I haven't yet a plan of what to do beyond "don't get murdered at a seaside fair," but for now that requires staying out of sight. The highwaymen file past us, the one with the gold ring in the lead. He's got his hand over his face, rubbing his temples. But as it drops, I catch a glimpse of his profile and recognition dawns suddenly upon me. I know him. And he's most certainly not a highwayman. It's the Duke of Bourbon. He starts to turn his head toward us, livid bruise coming into view, and my heart nearly throws itself to its death. But at the same minute, a firework explodes overhead, turning the navy sky bright red. The highwaymen all look up, and Percy, Felicity, and I, seemingly of the same mind on the subject of not getting murdered, duck the rest of the way down the row, then around the corner and out of sight. We stop between two tents, canvas shielding us on all sides from the crowds gathered along the pier. The ground is peppered with stakes wedged into the planks and straining against the ropes strung taut between them. It's a narrow corridor to walk.
I know him,
I hiss.
What?
Felicity replies. She's got one hand pressed to her chest, breathing hard.